for more great programming. Linda Olson-Osterlin is up next.
Thanks so much.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Unless otherwise noted, the Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday at 4:30 p.m.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Soaring Spirits Gala on Saturday, October 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church in Vancouver. The third Soaring Spirits Gala benefit concert features Heather Keller of Beauty of the Harp and the Celtic duo of Valerie K. Blessy and Jennifer Pratt Walter. The first half of the concert will focus on melodies of pre-Christian epic poetry and Jewish Kabbalah music. The second half features secular early traditional music and original music compositions by these artists. Again, that's the Soaring Spirits Gala on Saturday, October 19th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the All Saints Episcopal Church, 2206 Northwest 99th Street in Vancouver, Washington. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a talk by Alex Vitale on Saturday, October 12th at the Dismantle Change Build Center in Portland. Alex Vitale, director of the Brooklyn College Policing and Social Justice Project, is the author of The End of Policing. He'll be speaking on how to reconstruct police culture and behavior and describe alternatives that remove the police from dealing with drug addiction, houselessness, sex work, mental health crises, and more. Again, that's Alex Vitale on Saturday, October 12th, 6 p.m. at the Dismantle Change Build Center, 14 Northeast Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Time is 9:03 and you're listening to KBOO Community Radio. Today on Radio Zine, writer and investigative journalist Andy Worthington will join KABU's Linda Olson-Osterlin to talk about Guantanamo Bay.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to KBOO Community Radio. I know you've just been listening to Paul Roland have a great show, and thank you for keeping tuned in. I'm your host, Linda Olson-Osterlund, and my guest is, as we just heard, is Andy Worthington, and he's on the line from England. So let me tell you a little bit about Andy. Some of you have maybe heard me talk with him before in the past. He's a writer, a campaigner, an investigative journalist, a commentator. He's internationally recognized as an authority on Guantanamo and the war on terror, and is involved in all sorts of other important issues in London, like the housing issues. He's also a singer and a songwriter, a photographer, and also a co-editor and generator of a film about Guantanamo. His most important book, I will say, is The Guantanamo Files, the stories of the 774 detainees held in America's illegal prison. This came out in 2006, and there have been updates so that you know more on his website, which is andyworthington.co.uk. Welcome to KBOO, Andy.
Hello, Linda. How are you?
Well, you know, we live in America in this time of everything, so I'm good within that context. How about you? You live in a country also in crisis in similar ways.
Well, yeah, there's that. We have our specific political crises, and then we have a global ecological crisis as well.
So. Yeah, that can make us all
difficult
sad.
Difficult times, I think, Linda, really.
Yes, for everybody that I encounter, actually, without exception.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I think there's a small elite that thinks that they're okay, but they're not, obviously, because if the environment goes, they go too. But, yeah, they're making life extremely difficult for huge numbers of people, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think the plan is to go ahead and keep doing that. You know, I know you have the housing crisis there. We have something like 18,000 empty units of high-rise buildings that nobody can afford to buy into here in Portland, even though they're trying to recruit as many wealthy people as possible. And we have our streets filled with people living on them because they don't have enough wage to be able to stay in an apartment. So that those 18,000 speculative on the rich having securitized rentals is another way that's really harming people here and there. But let's talk about, you know, and it is important that we recognize that people are sort of inundated from all sides with particular crises. I mean, I can't believe there isn't a day that the president of the United States, the current president of the United States, doesn't throw a wrench into something and have everybody go, oh my, and for good reason. You know, you could say ignore them, but you'd be ignoring wars, et cetera. So, but I'm going to bring up Guantanamo because I think it's been easy to forget. And, you know, Andy, it was really discouraging when I went online to start pulling up articles about Guantanamo Bay and what's happening there. There were very, very few that I could find, at least in the way that the search engines nowadays want to give you news. You know, it's not quite as easy to
get
all news.
Well, I mean, you know, there's only really one reporter in the U.S. who's regularly writing about Guantanamo, which is Carol Rosenberg at the New York Times.
I'm so glad you brought her up.
Well, I mean, she's often the only person visiting Guantanamo, you know, paying attention to what's happening on the ground down there. You know, it's extraordinary. But as you say, in general, it's, you know, it's dropped almost completely off the radar in the U.S.
Yeah, you know, I even have a printout here of Carol Rosenberg, the announcement that she went to the New York Times. Her own newspaper was laying bunches of people off, the Miami Herald. But the recognition of her work, I would have been devastated to find they just sidelined her and we had to try to find her on a blog somewhere. I think she landed in an appropriately important venue and maybe they'll let her do reporting.
You know, I think she probably wouldn't have been able to do it either, you know, because it takes money to visit Guantanamo. They don't make it easy. So,
yes.
You know, you kind of need institutional backing to do it. So, yeah.
Yeah, I also saw Guantanamo mentioned in a local newspaper here, Street Roots, which has an article on a friend of mine and a former Black Panther, Kent Ford, and he, in some of his opening statements where they were quoting him, was talking about Guantanamo and how important it was not to forget about the way that we've locked these people up indefinitely. And I was so happy just to see it on his mind, and therefore it goes on the minds of everybody who reads that article about him while it's out in that newspaper Street Roots here in town. So I encourage people just to, the whole article is good. It's not about Guantanamo, but that he still keeps it present in his mind as important for us to be paying attention to.
I think a lot of people who have had experience of, you know, the U.S. penal system, and maybe particularly in connection with anything that can be seen as political in any way, would understand the terrible truth about what's happening at Guantanamo to non-citizens, you know.
Yes.
But it's always good when people recognize the significance of it and mention it, as you say.
Yeah, it helps keep it alive in our minds, and I think that's terribly important in these days. So I was looking at what information there is out there, and there is, there are some things going on. There was, recently it came out there were some secret records of recording of Guantanamo Bay detainees when they were out talking among each other, and that came out in a case. There was also, you wrote, at the end of last year about the review boards not serving the people that they saw. And most recently, one thing that was interesting was that it was a judge at Guantanamo actually mentioned that there was real torture involved in a case. Are there any of the particular, well, why don't you tell us a little bit more, give us an overview of who's still there and talk about some of these particular cases, if you would. I should also...
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, there are 40 people still held at Guantanamo. Since he came into office, Donald Trump has only released one prisoner. And that was because he agreed a plea deal in his military commission trial under President Obama, which stipulated that in exchange for him cooperating with prosecutors, he would be sent back for continued imprisonment in Saudi Arabia. If it wasn't for that, no one would have left Guantanamo. We all know, I hope everyone realizes, that even before he got into office, just a couple of weeks before his inauguration, Donald Trump tweeted, there must be no more releases from Guantanamo, and he's been true to his word. And the problem, of course, is that, as it's always been with Guantanamo, this is not a prison where people are held in any way that most of us would think is legally acceptable, even though it has the appearance of legality because of the laws that were passed to establish it. But if you or I were to be deprived of our liberty, Linda, we would either be arrested by a law enforcement officer and charged with a crime, put on trial, and if convicted, given a sentence and put in a federal prison. Or if we were captured in wartime, we would be taken off the battlefield and we could be held unmolested until the end of hostilities. And, of course, that isn't what's happened to these men. These men, some of them were civilians in the wrong time and the wrong place, bought for bounty payments. Some of them were undoubtedly soldiers. They were fighting with the Taliban against the Northern Alliance, and then 9/11 happened, and then suddenly they became the enemies of the United States. But some of these men are still in Guantanamo, people who really were incredibly insignificant. And, I can't think of any other instance in the modern era where you would have a government claiming that after 18 years, the war in which it was holding these people was still ongoing. And I think as time goes on, that's one of the really alarming things about Guantanamo, is the war really does seem to be going on forever. And there is literally no mechanism whereby any of these people can get out of Guantanamo. They are at the whim of the President of the United States, to some extent Congress as well, but primarily they are the personal prisoners of the President of the United States. And when that man is Donald Trump and doesn't want to do anything, absolutely nothing happens. So the men are getting older, they're getting more ill, and there is very literally almost nothing resembling justice for any of them. A handful of men that are regarded as significant, and this includes the men allegedly responsible for the 9/11 terrorist attacks, are, caught up in an endless kind of groundhog day of pre-trial hearings for their trials. And the problem with that is that the prosecution doesn't want to reveal anything about how they were tortured so horribly in CIA black sites, and the defense insist that they can't have a fair trial unless they are allowed to openly discuss the fact that these men were tortured. And then for the rest of the prisoners, they're simply stuck. So five of the men were actually approved for release by review processes established under Barack Obama, but they didn't get released before he left office, and there's no legal requirement for Trump to do anything, so he hasn't. And the rest of them are what the mainstream media has called forever prisoners, which I think is very appropriate. So these are men who are held indefinitely without charge or trial. So they're not going to be prosecuted, and neither have they been approved for release. And President Obama set up a parole-type review process to look at the cases of these and many dozen of other men in the last few years that he was in office. And that led to 38 decisions being taken that the men had shown sufficient contrition, regardless of whether or not they'd committed the crimes they were accused of. You know, this is a parole-type process, but for people who've never been convicted of anything. And were also able to demonstrate that they were going to peacefully construct a life for themselves after Guantanamo and would do nothing to harm the U.S. or its interests. And those people were released, apart from two men who were stuck at Guantanamo. But the review process continues, and it gives Trump the ability to claim that there is still a review process in place at Guantanamo, that they're not just indefinitely imprisoned without charge or trial for the rest of their lives. But get this, the reviews that have taken place since he took office, not a single one has approved any of these 26 men for release.
Yeah, but I've been impossible. Looking at some of these and some of these men, you know, one man named Mohammed Al-Qahtani is schizophrenic. He was schizophrenic before he came to Guantanamo, and he's schizophrenic now, and he doesn't receive appropriate treatment, and he clearly couldn't have been the person that they thought he was in terms of the actions he carried out because of his mental illness, and yet he's still there, not being treated appropriately and not being released to people who could take care of him.
Well, the story is that he was meant to be the 20th hijacker for 9/11, but he wasn't the 20th hijacker for 9/11, and surely we must conclude from this that he is a man with severe mental health issues. And, you know, so he should be released back to Saudi Arabia, I think. I think that should be pretty clear. I mean, also, you know, recently, because what's happening now is that the prisoners are boycotting these reviews, the periodic review boards. They're saying there's no point in us even turning up because we know that it's a broken process. It's a sham. It's a joke. That's been happening all year, is that they're boycotting the review process. And the most recent boycott was by, he's still a young man. He's a young man who's spent over half his life in U.S. custody. He's called Hassan bin Attash. He's 34 now. He was 16 or 17 years old when he was first picked up by the U.S. authorities in Pakistan. So he's spent over half his life in U.S. custody. He was a juvenile when he was seized, which means
he should have been treated differently.
He should have been separated from adult prisoners and rehabilitated rather than punished. Those are the rules of the UN Convention on the Treatment of Children in Wartime, to which the United States signed up. But you know, his elder brother, is one of the alleged 9/11 hijackers, and he was captured with alleged 9/11 planners. And he was captured with another of the alleged 9/11 planners. But juveniles are fundamentally not responsible for their actions. He was put in that place because of the connections of his brother. He personally was, you know, if we stop thinking that juveniles are responsible for their actions, we're heading in a dark place. And actually, that's been the history of Guantanamo, you know.
Yeah, we know Omar Khadr, who was there, and he was so brutally treated in the months and years before he got released, and still has physical injuries that are significant from his treatment. And he was, you know, he was a child with his father. I think he went willingly into what he was doing because he wanted to be with his father and not left with the women. But he was not by any means ideologically a part of the violence and actions. And
you can't be considered responsible for your actions at that age. If we look at the approach that people have to child soldiers elsewhere in the world, you know, liberals in general are completely understanding that they were put into harm's way by people older than them who were responsible for them.
Yes, but, like child soldiers in Liberia or other places.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and certainly with Canada, because Canada abused Omar Khadr's rights, Canada, you know, politically had a very good record otherwise of understanding and looking after child soldiers from other conflicts. But when it came to its own citizen, you know, as I hope your listeners know, there was a huge amount of hostility towards Omar Khadr from the Canadian people, which was, you know, completely unacceptable.
Yes, and he was being held responsible for some, you know, vitributive things that his an older sister was saying that didn't reflect, they hadn't, you know, didn't ref, they reflected her point of view, not his point of view.
Well, yeah, you become held, you know, responsible, you become guilty by association with your family members, if you like, which is not a basis for a justice system, is it?
No. Let me tell our audience out there that this will be a call-in opportunity for you, the listener. I'd like to hear from you about your thoughts about Guantanamo Bay and about going, you know, how are we to handle this, you know, never-ending imprisonment of people, something we don't believe in unless you can prove the case, and the case has not been proven on almost all of the men still in Guantanamo. Actually, none of them have had fair trials, so you can't say it's been proven in any of their cases. So please.
That's right, yeah. There's one person there who was convicted, but I don't think it was a fair trial. It took place 11 years ago, and he refused to mount a defense. He didn't take part in the process at all. He didn't recognize its legitimacy, and he received a life sentence, which, you know, he's serving at Guantanamo. And in fact, in the years since then, most of the charges on which he was convicted have been thrown out because they weren't legitimate war crimes. They were war crimes that were invented by Congress. But, there's one little element of the conviction that remains in place, and there he is. He's still held there. He's imprisoned completely on his own because he's the only, you know, convicted prisoner, and they separated him from everybody else. Everywhere you look at Guantanamo, really, there are just these horrendous stories of the way that people are being abused. And I don't mean to suggest that if people have done something wrong that they shouldn't go through a process and be punished at the end of it if they're found guilty, but Guantanamo doesn't work. Everywhere that it tries to apply justice, that justice is so broken that it fails.
Yes. You know, I want to remind the listeners that the phone number is 503-231-8187. And just one second, I think we have a caller on the line. Do we have a caller on the line? Tammy is my engineer. No, we don't. I was misconstruing her signals because I have bad glasses. And she's in another room waving at me through a phone. So anyway, the phone number is 503-231-8187. We really would like to hear from you about Guantanamo Bay, about how it fits into everything else going on in this nation, the revelations we've been getting over the last many years about what kind of nation are we really, have been very painful for a lot of us. And so I'm inviting you to call in and talk about this and talk about, did Guantanamo pave the way for the way that we're handling asylum seekers on the southern border? Did our long-term inability to refute torture and the inappropriate imprisonment of people open the door in a way, normalize in a way, the door for people to be held in secret in ways we don't want to know but we know are bad? So I'm asking you, the audience, that question. I think I asked myself that question as well. I did notice, Andy, when I was looking through some of the people that were still there and couldn't make it through their parole board, their those reviews. One was a man called Harun Al Afghani. Also Harun Gol. Can you talk about him a little bit? He sounds like he was really well liked and like kind of special inside Guantanamo.
Well, I mean, the most shocking thing I remember about his case, which I have to say I haven't refreshed my memory on it lately, Linda.
Yeah,
I know that he didn't have any legal representation until just a few years ago. And, you know, and he got a very capable U.S. lawyer, Shelby Sullivan Bennis, who was working with Reprieve and has been working with a lot of the prisoners. And actually, that's not a unique story. There are men in Guantanamo who simply haven't even had the lifeline that is represented by having an attorney try and do what they can in the face of this, you know, blanket hostility towards releasing anyone or giving them any kind of fair hearing. And so, you know, that was the most prominent thing that I remember about his case, was that he was one of these people. But I think he's a case of mistaken identity, yeah?
Yeah, well, and what's sad is that he doesn't one of the main reasons he may not be released is because he doesn't have a life outside prison waiting for him. His family, he spoke to his mother the last time for many years, and she's not been located again, and no family. So he has an unfunded life. There is a project, it says, though, that is trying to take him through a project called the Unfunded Life After Guantanamo Project.
Okay.
Yeah, and it says that his family remains ready and available to assist him in the unlikely event that he requires their support. He's got all sorts of talents. He should be released, and he's not released. I mean, he's a kind of person that all of us could feel comfortable having in our neighborhoods if we weren't embedded with racism.
here's another problem as well, Linda. So Haroon is placed in this very difficult position where, because he can barely establish contact with anybody in Afghanistan, and because even if he could, they're not in a position to guarantee to the United States that he can, you know, have this peaceful life after Guantanamo, then they're not going to approve his release in the first place. Now, an additional problem is that even if they did, the Congress, for many years under the Republicans, has refused to allow prisoners to be released to Afghanistan, so he couldn't be sent home anyway.
And they won't allow us in the United States. Like, say we said, we want to adopt this guy. We will officially adopt him.
Not.
We're not allowed
total
to
prohibition.
Do that.
But it would mean that he would have to be resettled in a third country that was prepared to take him in. And when Donald Trump came into office, one of the first things that he did was to scrap the office of the envoy for Guantanamo closure, which President Obama had set up. And a crucial part of that job was dealing with the resettlement of prisoners.
Yes. So.
It's also, you know, worth noting for any of your listeners who are very concerned about national security issues, that the role of the envoy was also to maintain contact with countries in which prisoners had been resettled, to make sure that, you know, if they thought it was necessary, they were keeping tabs on them.
So now we no longer have anybody keeping tabs on the prisoners. They like
there's absolutely nothing.
They like to bring up mythical, mythical cases of them.
Like so many parts of the government under Donald Trump, it's just disappeared.
Yes.
You know? But that was a pretty crucial role.
It looks like we have a caller. So, yeah. Let's go ahead and let the caller on.
Oh, greetings, everyone, and thank you for taking my call.
Who is this?
This is Harry.
Hi, Harry.
Yes. A few questions. First of all, why did the Bush administration pick Guantanamo Bay? Was it to embarrass Fidel Castro? And, you know, it didn't seem that facility could hold a prison.
Well, I mean, it has been a prison before, actually, in that they used it in the 90s to temporarily imprison refugees from Haiti. But they chose it very specifically in the context of the war on terror, because they wanted a prison that would be beyond the reach of the U.S. courts. That was very specifically their intention. They wanted to take these men there and do whatever they wanted to do to them without being challenged. And it took many years for the courts to be able to challenge them on that. That was fundamentally it. I mean, it's very cynical.
Oh, yeah. What about the UN and the Pope? Did they ever say anything about Guantanamo, how unfair it is?
Yeah, I don't know that the Pope has ever said anything, but the UN definitely has. But the problem, of course, that the UN has is that no one has power over the United States to compel the United States to do anything. All they can do is give advice, give strongly worded criticism, but there's no legal mechanism whereby anyone can hold the United States accountable for anything that it does. The only way that could happen would be internally in the United States itself. And as we've seen, that hasn't happened. Everything that George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and all these people did, they got away with. They weren't punished in any way. They all wrote books and went on book tours. And as far as I can see now, George W. Bush is being quite severely rehabilitated by people in the U.S. media.
He ordered waterboarding. He actually ordered it. He said it in his book. You know, he's a war criminal.
Well, there you go, exactly.
Well, and yeah. I think just to add into this, they did not want to bring them inside the courts of the United States because they didn't want to follow the rules of the courts. If they did, they would have to allow the information and the specifics about the torture of these individuals out into the courtroom, and it would inevitably make any prior statements from them not be allowed to be considered because they came as a result of torture. So I think, they didn't want them, they wanted them out of the reach of U.S. courts.
Okay. One of the things I was upset about Obama was one of his campaign promises was to close Guantanamo. And if you look at the Constitution, who's the commander-in-chief of the armed forces? He is. He can just order it. Congress doesn't have anything to do with it. And that's one thing I was upset. How come he just didn't just close it like he said?
Well, exactly. Sorry, Linda.
Well, I was just going to say he didn't really have cojones when it came to action for the people. I mean, look what he allowed to happen on the southern border. So much of the abuses going on there have been greatly increased, but they were going on under Obama, including children being separated from their families.
I think he tried
as hard as he could do to sound well and get some people out, but he knew he was, there's a comment, a quote of his saying, some folks got tortured. Was the way he referred to the people who got tortured. And some people will never be able to be released because of what they did. But it's not because of what they did. It's because of what was done to them.
Okay.
Yeah. And he moved slowly. He had to be constantly pressurized. And sure, he released nearly 200 people during the 8 years of his presidency. But crucially, he left the prison open. And, it was as though he had absolutely no consideration that what happened if you leave this place open and then someone like Donald Trump becomes president? I suspect that what he'd been thinking was that Hillary Clinton was going to take it over, and there may have been...
Boy, she might have just laughed as they died. I don't know Hillary. She's got a bloodthirst.
How outrageous. Sorry, Linda.
I was going to say, Hillary Clinton has a bloodthirst if you listen to how she talked about Gaddafi. I wouldn't really trust her too much in that position.
I wouldn't either, but she was definitely part of negotiations about the closure of Guantanamo. And to be honest, the position that we're in now, Linda, and your listeners, is that, it's nothing's going to happen under Donald Trump. Given their history, I don't think anything's going to happen under the Republicans, full stop. So, we're in this position of looking, if people are interested in the closure of Guantanamo, or actually looking at which Democrats are interested in even discussing it.
Yeah, who would even mention it? It's off the mark as much as they even don't want to mention the environment. I think one did in our debates last night. Even though the streets are full of people wanting to talk about the environment, if they can avoid that, they're certainly going to avoid Guantanamo. It looks like we have another caller on the line. I want to thank you.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry, Harry. We lost her. But thank you, Harry, and we'll go on. We'll get another caller. The number is 503-231-8187. In the reading that I was doing this morning a little bit earlier, I saw that there's a habeas corpus case still winding its way through the courts with regard to Guantanamo. Is that accurate?
Yes, I think that is. This is the prisoners who are trying to get a judge to accept that because of Donald Trump's prejudice towards them, you know, there is no possibility of them getting any justice. And, you know, I don't understand why that seems to have stalled, that case. I know sometimes legal cases take a long time, but it's nearly 2 years since that was first submitted, and I know that the oral arguments took place last summer.
How were they making that argument? Do you remember a little bit of that?
Well, the lawyers.
Yeah, how's it a habeas corpus?
They were basically citing all the examples of Trump's animosity towards the prisoners as evidence that there was no way that he was going to deliver anything resembling justice to them, and which I think is fair enough when you have a president who tweets there must be no more releases from Gitmo. You know, that's a pretty serious statement. And when, as time goes on and you realize that he has been true to his word, then, you know, it seems to me that they must have a case. And I actually think, Linda, as the prison, you know, goes on and on and on, and we're close to the 18th anniversary of its opening, which is in January, I think, you know, people who are prepared to be concerned about it are concerned that it appears to be going on forever.
Stalled as a never-ending, you know, indefinite imprisonment, which is one of the things it does share with the southern border, because our Supreme Court has said that people who are being detained, who are seeking asylum, can be held indefinitely. Shocking and wrong and immoral, but that's what they're saying, and it's a hard one to, it's an important case to fight. We do have another caller, though. Let's get him on the line. Hi, who have I got there?
Yeah, this is Chris in Portland. How's it going?
Hi, good. Hi, Chris.
Thank you so much for allowing me to join the discussion. I just kind of wanted to string together a couple of thoughts that I had as we're talking about America as this global police force, if you will. I wonder if our attempts or hopes to find justice, and I'm using air quotes when I say that, has led us to be obviously very have a lot of oversight in our judgments as to where guilt lies. This seems like something that predates the Trump presidency, but obviously is emboldened by that. I just wondered your guys' thoughts on that.
Well, say a little bit more about what you mean.
Yeah, so in these various cases that you've been bringing up, the theme seems to be that we have made a judgment as to their guilt way hastily, way too quickly. And this, while it seems like it's obviously something that President Trump is doing, I wonder if you guys' thoughts on, you know, previous presidents, how they're...
I get it, Chris. I mean, this was definitely the setup that, you know, that Obama first and now Trump inherited from George W. Bush. So, you know, the blame for the inherent problems of Guantanamo are absolutely all George W. Bush's fault, because he set up a prison where, as you say, he concluded that everyone that the United States rounded up was guilty without going through any kind of due process to establish whether that was the case. And unpicking that after the event is, you know, is part of the reason that we're still in this mess now. You know, one of the things that is supposed to happen in wartime, for example, is that if people aren't traditionally wearing, you know, military uniforms, which is, you know, the situation that that was happening in Afghanistan, where the Taliban were, you know, had irregular militia. It wasn't like the 19th century where everybody's wearing their official military uniforms. So it's easy under those circumstances to capture civilians instead of soldiers, because you don't know who's who. And what you're supposed to do under the Geneva Conventions, which the United States observed in all of its wars up to the invasion of Afghanistan, was that you hold what are called competent tribunals close to the time and place of capture, where people who claim that they're civilians can call witnesses, and if, you know, and if mistakes are exposed, then those people are sent home. In the Gulf War in 1991, the United States held about 1,300 of these tribunals, and in three quarters of the cases, established that they captured civilians rather than combatants and sent them home. So these were like, you know, a farmer traveling through the battle zone who's apprehended.
They civilians also, our earlier lessons, our military clearly learned but didn't apply later.
Yeah. And nothing, none of these took place for the Guantanamo prisoners. This is why part of the reason that Guantanamo ended up being full of people who shouldn't have been there was because they never went through this screening process. You know, the other thing the U.S. was doing was it was paying bounty payments of thousands of pounds, which is a huge amount of money in Afghanistan and Pakistan, for people who, you know, the people who handed them over would claim they were Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. But, you know, that wasn't a process that that was fair either. And so loads of other people who were not who the U.S. said they were ended up in custody.
Well, and I've heard Afghanis say that they that it was get all the Arabs out and we'll trade them on the way out. And so it was a conscious Afghan people who were, you know, not wanted by the locals were immediately, especially people of Arabic ancestry, were pushed out of the country and then picked up at the borders and at the crossings to be sold to the United States.
And in Pakistan, the president at the time, Musharraf, wrote an autobiography in which he boasted that in exchange for handing over Arabs that were not wanted in Pakistan, fundamentally, they got, you know, millions of dollars from the United States. So, yeah, the whole lesson of Guantanamo, really, which won't be learned until the place is closed, is when it comes to imprisoning people, don't start with your presumptions about them. Go through the due processes that have been put in place for a long time for very good reasons, because you need to assess who you've got, you know, if you're going to deprive them of their liberty. And that is the great tragedy of Guantanamo. And I think because of the general failure of the mainstream media to truly understand how shameful this has been, you know, this may not fully come out until one day, I hope, the prison is closed and it will become one of those great crimes that is looked back on and that will eventually be understood, that it was catastrophically bad how the arrogance of tearing up all of the rules and laws and treaties that existed meant that, you know, the United States ended up imprisoning huge numbers of people who were insignificant, and even worse, in a lot of cases, thinking that these people were actually terrorists trained to withhold information, in which case it then tortured them because it thought they had been trained to resist interrogation.
Well, and there is also a terror program in place by Jessam and Mitchell, the two men psychologists from the U.S., and I think they were purposely experimenting on all of the people who came there. They originally, we were talking about this earlier, they wanted to keep Guantanamo Bay undercover. They did not want it to come out how many prisoners there and what they were doing, because they wanted to. They considered it an interrogation center, and they experimented psychologically on these people with all sorts of horrible ways, you know, from sleep deprivation
absolutely.
To force feeding to, you know, and keeping distinct records that no doubt will get used by some totalitarian state in the future, because that's how it went with Nazi Germany, you know. We brought them
part
home.
Of the U.S.'s history of human experimentation,
yes,
sadly.
Yes, yes, exactly. Well, thank you very much, Chris. Anything else you wanted to say?
I really appreciate your guys' time. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you. Let me check with our engineer, Tammy, to see if there are any more callers. Not yet. The number is 503-231-8187. Any of your questions or comments about Guantanamo Bay? Is that we're going to go on influencing the way that we treat other people, including on the southern border. So I just want to bring that up. We have true horrors going on our southern border, where people seeking asylum have had their children ripped from them and placed in some of those children have been placed in facilities that are horrifying, literally no clean food, no ability to, you know, sleeping on hard floors with no blankets, 12-year-old kids taking care of other little children who've been separated from their parents. And our current president's determination, if he could, he would, well, we'd rather shoot them on the other side of the, quote, wall. Or I think he's following Israel's, he said, well, can't we shoot him in the leg? I think he's following Israel's lead there. But definitely we are detaining families, children in horrible conditions, and we're not telling them when it ends. And so,
absolutely.
So there's something that has, I want to say, it slithered over from Guantanamo. It's part of the lexicon of, what would you call it? It's not, you know, the military down there necessarily. It's protection, quote, you know, the homeland. Nowadays also, we hear our commentators speak about the homeland. And we have for many years, but it seems to be coming up more and more. And that just smells like Nazism to me. That's this, you know, like our homeland has energy security and taking another country's oil. That's what they mean. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, the homeland issues. I mean, we're going through it at the moment, obviously, with a very divided Britain about whether to leave the EU or not, and that kind of language is becoming more dominant. And the fact is, you know, Trump's notion of a wall, Trump's notion, horrific notion of, you know, of shooting people, actually reflects the kind of fortress mentality that large parts of our population now want. And those of us who recognize that actually, you know, apart from anything else, it's the damage that we've caused all over the place that means that we as relatively wealthy countries should still keep our doors open to people in need. It's a very big divide. Like, I think there are lots of serious ideological divides going on there. They're getting more exacerbated. And, you know, with people like Trump in power in America, obviously it becomes much more extreme. And unfortunately, you know, we now have our equivalent of him in the form of Boris Johnson, who's, you know, contempt for
he's the cheerful looking Trump, right?
they're disturbingly similar, I think, in a lot of ways. But you know, but he's pushing dangerous far right propaganda lines.
Well, and the constant languaging of people who are from other nations and or of not the mainstream ethnicity, it wears in. You know, it's like, you know, you hear those words over and over again. Like people who lived in the South who grew accustomed to hearing the N-word, even if they wouldn't use it, they wouldn't stop others from using it because it seemed to be everywhere. And certainly in this nation, I don't know about in your own, but our military is just so over the top lauded for everything. You know, it's definitely a way of trying to make us feel like we are at a war that we're not. You know, we're really not.
Yeah,
what was it? 11 of us died five of us died compared to the 11,000 that died on the other side in the Syrian war that we're responsible for killing. I mean, we just are not in the position that's being described, but it gets described over and over again. And actually, I'm scared to death in some ways because how is it that we're still having these detention centers? How is it that we haven't found any way to shut them down? Will the Democrats, when they get in power, will they shut them down, really? Obama was not a lot better.
No, and I think there needs to be a kind of political change, doesn't there? That's what I meant about fundamental differences in the way that the citizens of both our countries are treating difficult issues, like the fact that the pressures on other countries in the world, very, very largely to do with the way that we have behaved over decades and centuries, is driving people in larger numbers towards us. And if we don't take them in, the only other option is that, you know, we don't just build a wall, we build a wall higher, and then we start shooting people. It really is.
Yeah,
as a human being, we have to take sides, and, you know, we need a political party that has our point of view rather than as you note, Linda, just being a maybe slightly less horrible version of the Republicans, which is so often the way the Democrats have manifested themselves.
Yes. You know, and I'm concerned about the changing climate and the people who have to flee from climate change, say, you know, the heat waves in India and people and the lack of water in one whole major city of India, where that's 11 million people, I believe, was what I looked at, or something like that, that have to move.
Yeah.
They have to move. And that means they're going to be on the move. And that means probably a whole bunch of them are going to die while they're on the move. And where are they going to go? And how are they going to be received? And I think that, you know, the as human beings, the only way that we can live together on this planet, and especially also with the animals and stuff, and solve the harm we've caused to the planet, is if we can, treat each other as the solutions. I mean, be friends with, that's our sister, that's our brother, that's our neighbor, and join together in solving these. But I fear it's going to be like one of those bad horror movies, you know, where everybody's locked in the basement ready to shoot the people who are begging to get in. And
especially in a country with so many guns like the U.S.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We are gun crazy in this country. That is for sure. You know, I did a little target practicing at one time, and I found I really enjoyed it. But I not because I wanted to shoot anybody, but just because it's a skill you can get. So I had to put those away because I didn't think I really needed to be skilled at a gun. You know, it was going to be fun for me shooting targets. So, but I'd be for us getting rid of most of the guns in this country. You know, we do have a caller. Let's get her on the line. Hello, are you there? Hi.
Hi.
Hi, what's your name?
Wade.
Hi, Wade. Welcome to KBOO, and you're listening to me and Andy Worthington from the UK.
Mm-hmm. So we're on?
Yep, you're on.
Okay, well, because I'm listening to the radio and it sounds like somebody else is on.
I know you. I can hear that really light in the background that you're hearing the radio, but we can hear you well if you can talk over it.
All right. Well, I thought an interesting point might have got missed, but was made earlier about trying someone as an adult when they're not. Mm-hmm. And they do this here, too. In the U.S., they do this. Kids are 15 or whatever. But that's a very important point that a person is not... Hang on. Yeah, no, I'm getting it. So I'm being pre-recorded. Is that it? Okay.
No, I don't think so. I don't... I know it goes out 40 seconds slower on the radio line than it does on the computer, but...
I'm sorry. Hang on a second. I got to turn off this other radio. I lose my thought. I have both. Okay, hang on a sec. Okay, now. So the...
Hi, Linda. I'm back.
Yeah, hi. Okay. We've got...
The dangerous precipice is that you could start, jailing your babies in the bathroom if they poop their pants or something. You see, you can't try somebody for something they're not responsible for. The person can't make that decision until he reaches that. We've decided that as a nation or whoever, that's the line. And now they're saying, oh, well, we just want to say that they did. Well,
yeah.
You know, you can't do that. So you can just keep going back. We can start trying, you know, six-year-olds for getting into the cookie jar.
Well, apparently there are some police in this United States who have actually arrested a six-year-old for a temper tantrum at her school. And I do believe they're now fired. But I hear what you're saying. You know, yeah.
Well, I just thought of something else, actually, that maybe that's why I don't know if the word is pejoratively, because I'm not in this group, but people accept this type of torture and stuff because our childhoods are rather brutal sometimes.
Oh, well, I hope it's not
much ingrained in the culture. You got me?
I don't know about you, but I think the reason that we take child soldiers and we blame them is because their physical body makes them look older than they are. I know here in Oregon, we try children We're one of the worst states, actually, in the United States for trying younger and younger children for capital crimes, things they should never been tried for. We now know the way the brain works, that most young men do not have all their impulse control brain structure in place until they're over 21. And I know in Europe, I believe, and maybe in England, kids are still considered legitimately living at home at age 21 and 22. So when we imprison these children who have not the ability to make those decisions, it's obviously cruel. But we do it here in our juvenile justice system in Oregon, and it has not been overturned yet. How is that over in London, in UK?
Well, in terms of the way juveniles are treated, Linda?
Yeah, do they put them, can they try them for capital crimes and things like that?
No, I think there's a thing that there's a pretty serious divide as to what the law applies to until you're over 18. I think specifically with relation to Guantanamo, and one of the reasons that you're saying that it had such a pernicious effect on infecting the U.S. in general, was how specifically the Bush administration denied that they were holding children at Guantanamo. And then when they were forced to acknowledge that they were holding children, they said they weren't really children.
They went out of their way to make them sound really awful, you know, and which was just not possible to do. And I know on Omar Khadr, the wounds on him were devastating, and yet he was if you saw some of the pictures of him when he was first picked up, he had a giant hole in his chest, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, shocking.
And
really
yet
shocking.
He was beaten even in that condition, et cetera. Yeah, I think a large part of it is the fact that young males can look adult at 14. They have the body size, and so people think then they can pick up the gun, then they can be the man of the house. We just know better now. We should know better now. We know from science and from looking at brains that that's just not true, that people need more time to grow up and get that wisdom that has them be able to stop their hand. I remember my son, he'll forgive me for this, I'm sure he's much past it, but he called me because he was caught by the police, and he said, "Mom, you won't believe it, it was so dumb." I said, "What'd you do?" He said, "I stole beer off of a truck out front of a grocery store." I said, "What?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I even turned to my friend and said, I think this is really stupid. We're not going to get away with it, but I did it anyway." There's a 16-year-old who can't control his impulse, while there's another part of him saying, "Ah, this is really stupid." And I think that's how we should treat young men. You know, he did his community service and got it expunged, I should say. Go ahead.
A grown-up way of dealing with it, doesn't it? You make mistakes because you don't you're not able necessarily to have reference to the experience to understand. You know.
Yes, exactly.
So your son understood that it was stupid, but not as much of an understanding as he would have had, hopefully, if he was, you know, in his 20s and the opportunity arose. He'd be like, no, really, you shouldn't do
that.
Yeah,
come on, guys, let's not jump up on that track.
You know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, it looks like we're running out of time. And so, Chris, is that the end with you there?
Yep, Wade,
go ahead.
I just wanted to say your prime minister looks like a street thug. He can't even comb his hair.
I think he looks like and this is a little sick, like a children's clown.
Yes.
A little scary. Well, you know, so let's remind people what they can do about Guantanamo. There is a website called closeguantanamo.org, right?
That's right, yeah.
And
we run a regular photo campaign there, where we have posters for every 100 days that the prison has been opened. So the one that's coming up on October the 28th is that Guantanamo will have been open for 6,500 days. So if people want to go to the website and get a copy of that poster and take a photo with it and send it to us, that would be great. People from all around the world hopefully will be taking part in the photo campaign.
And that's October 28th, and that's from going to that. They can just print off that sign,
they
right?
They can find it by going to closeguantanamo.org.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we didn't get the chance to discuss it today, Linda. Maybe I could come back when it's been finalized. But there are provisions regarding Guantanamo in the National Defense Authorization Act. Historically, there have been massive prohibitions on anything to do with Guantanamo imposed by the Republicans since Obama lost control of the Congress in his, you know, in the midterms, in his first term. In the midterms 2 years ago, when the Democrats took back the House, that means that some of those committees, and particularly the House Armed Services Committee, is actually trying to input things into the overarching military budget to try and ease some of those restrictions on Guantanamo. There isn't much in the media about it at all, you know, yet another shameful oversight. But I do encourage people to try and look out for things.
Do you know who in the U.S. Congress is working on that?
Well, it's various people in that committee and various other, you know, representatives. And what I'll do is I'm going to write something about that quite soon, which will be on closeguantanamo.org. And will also be on my website, andyworthington.co.uk, and that will really be in the next week or so. So if people are interested, I would really encourage them to keep an eye on the website, because that's where I try and make sure that I keep people who are interested, you know, up with what's happening at Guantanamo in the way that Carol Rosenberg does for the New York Times.
Yes. You know, I have a slot for the 31st of October. Let's be in communication about whether that would be a good time for you to come back on and talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely, Linda.
Yeah, it's Halloween here, so.
Yeah, I'm here.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining me, Andy Worthington. You can find him at andyworthington.co.uk, and be sure and check him out. And thanks for joining us again.
Always a pleasure, Linda. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I want to thank Tammy Hopteas for being our engineer this morning and for all of you listening and calling in.
Good morning, Portland. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. The time is 10 o'clock.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a development director. This position develops and implements a yearly fundraising plan, ensures we meet our revenue goals, and develops promotional and press materials. The ideal candidate will have at least 4 years proven development experience in the nonprofit sector and strong annual report, newsletter, and grant writing skills. KBOO is an affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. To apply, email a resume and cover letter to developmenthire@kboo.org. Deadline to apply is Monday, October 21st at 5 p.m. For more information, go to kboo.fm.